Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our diverse seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franson. Our guests today are bringing us up to date about how Ames is preparing to welcome Afghan refugees who left or are leaving Afghanistan after the departure of American troops in August. We have Diane Burt, who is working with several local immigrant relief organizations who are preparing to face the difficulties of resettling refugees and other immigrants. She has also brought Maria Hakimi, a graduate student from Northern Afghanistan, who has lived in the United States for several years. Would you please introduce yourself, Diane?
Yes, I'm Diane Burt. I'm with the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance. We established ourselves here in Ames 2015, 2016. And that time, our main objective, which continues, is to make Ames a welcoming place for refugees. We know that the world has a major refugee problem, and oftentimes people cannot go back to the country they have left. So they are looking for another place to go. And we are hopeful that Ames will be on the list of places where people can go. Our group works very closely with another group called the Ames Sanctuary Interfaith Partnership. That group is focusing more on helping folks get sanctuary. And this is helping asylum seekers. And they also would be interested in helpful in working with the Afghans, because the Afghans are coming in largely as humanitarian parolees, and they need to go the route of asylum seekers, which is a different route than refugees. And that's probably a different program for you to deal with. So the third group that has recently formed, that probably the community should have clarification on, is the Story County Immigrant and Refugee Collaboration, kind of develop on the heels of the Story County Emergency COVID Fund for Immigrants, which raised almost $400,000 and distributed it to folks who would not get any of the funding that came to help during COVID-19. These are largely immigrants. Some of the more recent refugees would get some of those funds because they would still be in the system. And of course, people who have gotten citizenship would get the federal funds, so they wouldn't be open for the emergency funds. But anyway, that group recently transferred its work in helping get funds for immigrants in Story County to the Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance Fund. They've continued their efforts in kind of having a place where all of the immigrant and refugee and asylum seeking support groups in the county can come together and talk about what they're doing and make sure that we're not missing something that we should be doing, and essentially make sure we don't overlap, but we support each other.
I have a question for you and Maria, because obviously Maria is not a refugee or an asylum seeker. So how did you meet?
When the Afghan evacuation occurred and it was clear that we were going to have a need for resettling these folks, the evacuees, the Afghan evacuees, in different communities, Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance decided it would be good to find out if there were Afghans in our community that could help us should we get an Afghan individual or family placed here. And one of our members, Jane Edwards, who has worked with the International Office at Iowa State, essentially went to them and had them send out notices to Afghan students to see if they would like to work with us. Did not connect us with them, but the international office kind of reached out. So maybe Maria can take it from here.
Oh, well, hi. I'm Maria Hakimi. As you mentioned, I'm a graduate student at Iowa State University. So as Diana explained, that how we met the international office had contacted me regarding how my family back home in Afghanistan was doing. And then they mentioned that there is a group in Ames helping, they could help settle in Afghan refugees coming in if we wanted to help out and volunteer, like with translation and things like that. So that was a great opportunity for me to jump in and hopefully be able to help, because in a way I felt a little bit helpless not being able to help my family in Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan there. So this would be a great way to pay it forward. But I also wanted to briefly mention that I am an asylum seeker myself, because I did come as an international student. Given the situation that Afghanistan is in, I haven't been able to go back for a long time. So I did change my status recently. My asylum was approved, but I'm in the process of waiting to get my green card right now.
How did you become a graduate student at Iowa State? When you left Afghanistan, how old were you and what was your education up to that point?
Well, when I left Afghanistan, I was 15. I had just turned 16 when I landed in the U.S. I came through an exchange program called YES, and it's funded by the State Department. So it was a year of high school in the States, and then you were placed, the kids were placed with host families, and host families were initially just volunteers. My host family happened to be in Iowa. They read my profile and they picked me. And so I stayed with them in Baxter, Iowa for 1 year of high school. It was my junior year. And then from there, when it was time for me to return back to go to Afghanistan, my host family, I don't really like calling them host family because I call them my mom and dad. So they offered to sponsor my college education. And that's how I was able to come back and continue. And I did my undergraduate at Iowa State in microbiology. And then now I'm a graduate student.
How long have you been here?
It's been 10 years, over 10 years now, yeah.
When I learned that there was a man who had applied to Ames specifically, I wondered whether it was someone who knew you, or can you explain that?
Yeah, so he's a family friend and I had never met him. But what happened was when I found out that he was one of the evacuees, I got in touch with him. He was staying at an army base in East Coast at that time. So he said that a lot of the Afghans are getting placed mostly in California, like in East Coast, because that's where a majority of Afghan population live in. So they have families, they have US ties. So when I got in touch with him, he was very interested to come to Iowa to be near me. So that's how he ended up requesting that, but he put me as his US tie and requested that he would be placed in Ames, Iowa, or somewhere near me, at least in Iowa.
Well, you said he was a family friend. Yesterday when we were talking, you told me what the connection was.
So yes, he's a family friend, and he's my sister's brother-in-law. So my sister is married to his brother. But I had never met him because when I was here when they were married, I haven't met that side of the family in person.
Well, that'll be an interesting reunion also.
Yes.
And initially, he was to be supported by the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants out of Des Moines. And they were agreeable to having him settle in Ames, and they would provide the support from Des Moines.
Well, then what happened? Why isn't he here?
I think it was almost the day that he flew to Iowa, we found out that they had changed the organization that would be providing him support. He is now getting his support from the Catherine McCauley Center in Cedar Rapids. And unfortunately, the Catherine McCauley Center cannot provide support to him if he moves to Ames. So at least for the time being, he's going to stay in Cedar Rapids where he can get their support, which I understand so far is going very well.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether he's Muslim. Are you, Maria?
Sorry, am I? Yes.
Yes. Well, I was going to comment that several years ago we did a program about the Mother Mosque in Cedar Rapids, and also the extensive support system that they have for their Islamic center there in mosque. It's really quite amazing. So it's a very good community for him to be in. Of course, we would like to start such a community here. the other person that we were put in touch with would like to talk more about that community. So we'll have a follow-up story.
Yes, definitely. I think that a lot of Afghans coming in, it's back in Afghanistan, people don't go to mosques as much. I think in here it becomes more of a community support because you meet people from your community. I think what's more important is like that people that come in from Afghanistan, they kind of have the community support from all backgrounds, not just Islam. You know, that way they can get adjusted very well. So I think that's the idea. Even with my friend, he's willing to go out of just not the mosque, just everywhere. Like myself, I've gone to churches more than mosques throughout my time here, just because learning, that's what my exchange program was all about. They wanted us to learn about the cultures in here so we could get rid of the misconceptions we have from both the countries. In Afghanistan, they have a lot of misconception about the American culture, and so is in US. So that's what the goal of the program was about.
Are you in touch with your family, Maria?
Yes, I am in touch with my family, but we are very careful how we communicate, given that the Taliban are back in control. So we just have to be on the safe side. Me being a female out in the West studying, it might not go very well. So we communicate via phone, like Skype or Facebook Messenger and things like that. So my whole family is back in Afghanistan right now, and they are doing well given the situation there. They're keeping a low profile, but we talk frequently and I check on them.
And they're safe?
They are safe, but you know that they have to follow everything that the Taliban are changing the law rules every day, and how people should act, how people should be. So they've been through this before. They know, my parents have gone through this. They know how to kind of deal with that kind of situation. Unfortunately, they're not able to leave Afghanistan at this time. All the borders in the neighboring countries are crowded with Afghan refugees trying to cross and go to different countries. And my parents had to make that decision and didn't want to traumatize my siblings there and try to get out of there when it's just really not possible and leave everything behind. So they have been staying put until the situation is right, they can leave to go to a different country.
Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you.
But one more thing, what do you hope for?
Do I hope for? Well, I just hope, I mean, we have to kind of think positively. I hope that the Taliban have changed, and I hope that people can live peacefully their life without war in Afghanistan. That's what we can hope for. I think the international community, I hope they keep a close eye on Taliban and keep the pressure on them so they can just let the people live their normal life. I mean, women are asking, or people in Afghanistan are asking, just for the basic human rights. So just rights for education, to work, and to lead a peaceful life. That's what I hope for Afghanistan for right now. And I hope that people who are coming in from Afghanistan get settled in and feel welcome here and start a new life safe.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Diane, for what you're contributing to making this happen.
It's been wonderful being on with you. Thank you.
As we close this segment of this program, Diane, would you please tell us some of the things that the Ames Refugee Alliance does to settle refugees?
Yeah, some of the things that the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance does to help welcome folks to our community are like English as a second language, or we more commonly call it English language learner classes. We did such classes up until the pandemic, and now we're starting to come back more on a one-on-one tutoring session. We've had about probably 8 to 12 families that we've been helping this way, largely the women, because I think it's harder with the work schedules and things for men, but largely with women, we've been helping with English skills. Largely, we've been helping former refugees. We had one refugee family come to Ames since the organization formed. Of course, since the organization formed, we've had quite a decrease in the number of refugees, asylum seekers brought in. The more recent presidential administration is starting to increase that again. And of course, the Afghan evacuees coming in through the channels used by refugees is helping rebuild the infrastructure for refugees. Some of the other things that the Ames Interfaith Alliance has been doing, connecting people with services, helping get the children in school, helping get some of the social services set up for people, the supplemental food types of benefits, helping with furnishings or household supplies, helping navigate things like, you know, taxes and transportation. And sometimes when the situation's right, helping people apply to get like wheels for work cars. So a variety of services is provided. And we're a volunteer organization. And anyone who's interested in working with us can find us on Facebook and Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance. And our regular meeting times are posted there.
سلام فرادی خوب هستی؟
سلام بابینی چی درستی؟
تشکر
جامعه جار ستمند شکر خود خدا
برای چی میگی بشه گامه که کشکی دوگانه جور کنیم؟
رو بیا آخری نامی زدیم لب هم ششتیم به خدا اکتیزه کم آمده هست سپرایز هست بیا جمع میکنیم به خیلی چیزه
یعنی بچه شما آمده ما
بر تا بعدم
بر خدا خدا بعدم
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we've just heard from Diane Burt and Maria Hakimi discussing the efforts to welcome Afghan refugees to Iowa. Our next guest for Black History Month is Love Tima, telling her own story of immigration, the neglected story of Liberia, and the heritage of America's stepchild.
My first name is Warlia. My middle name is Love. My last name is Tima. I am a Liberian. Also, you know, I say I'm a Liberian African-American because I am part of two cultures. I'm rooted in my Liberian culture, and I have been assimilated in my African-American culture as well as the American society. So I have a lot of experience on each platform. I've been in social service and healthcare for over 20 years. So I'm originally and born in Liberia, and I came to the United States in 1990. I was 7 years old and maybe 2 months shy from my 8-year birthday. And our first state that we landed was New York, and we stayed there for a few months. My dad was already here. My mom is the one that came and got us, me and my two other siblings at the time. And we came to Minnesota straight from New York. And I lived in Minnesota up until recently of 2021, around pretty much August, I came to Iowa.
Was there a Liberian community in Minnesota?
Oh, yes. The Midwest, Minnesota is the capital ground for the Midwest Liberians. That is the state capital for Liberians in the Midwest. When Liberians came in the 90s during the Civil War, when it really broke out, that is where the first Liberians, I think, in the United States landed was in Minnesota. And they were clustered, you know, they created a little village in Brooklyn Park.
So when you were talking about how Africans, you didn't say specifically Liberians, celebrated for days rather than just one day or a weekend. Now, is that specifically to you, Liberians, or would you generalize that to other Africans you know?
I would, you know, generalize it to other Africans about the way we celebrate certain events in our lives. But most West Africans will point to Liberians to really creating a festival of it more than others.
You mentioned the Civil War. I know about a lot of Civil Wars in various African countries, but I didn't know there was one in Liberia.
Oh, yes. You know, the relationship of the United States is so close to Liberia that Liberia is known as the stepchild of the United States, because during the colonial time where the back to Africa relocation time of the people that was enslaved in the United States began, their first trip of that relocation was actually to Sierra Leone, which is next to Liberia. And unfortunately, the condition, the environment, and you know, the atmosphere, everything did not, but the people that was enslaved that went back to Africa in that region, it didn't do them very well. They ended up getting really sick and end up dying. So the next trip was to Liberia. And that's where the former slaves settled. And that relationship between America and Liberia, that's how it got started.
Was it a friendly relationship? I mean, really helpful, or was it just dumped them there and said, okay, you're free and you're not going to be in our way anymore?
Well, you know, the fact that slavery is a difficult thing for a lot of people, difficult subject for a lot of people to talk about. It's a very oppressing, I don't want to say situation, kind of dilute what slavery is, but it's a very oppressing thing that happened to Africans that was, you know, kidnapped and bought and stole and brought here to the United States. That relocation was supposed to be a new beginning, but once again, when you take a group, even though they're Africans, to a region that is new to them because it wasn't their original home, because their family history, they're not the original Africans that was taken from Africa, that was brought back, it's, you know, generation has passed, you are bringing new immigrants, in a sense, to a new land with indigenous people and with different culture and ideas. And that will always create conflict because there's going to be a power struggle. So I think, you know, the relationship for the new, which we call Americo-Liberians and the United States, was a form of supporting of that new change, migration of better life. You know, it was the purpose for them to be able to control their own destiny, create, you know, start off fresh and build a new society or everything for themselves. And it sounds great, but there was a struggle because the former president at that time actually sent his nephew to Liberia to govern it. And so there was a struggle between the Americo-Liberians that came trying to be free and control their own destiny and their own government, and America still having some form of power. This is where, Joseph J.K. Roberts became the first governor before he became the first president of Liberia. And then that's where Liberia Independence, July 26, came about. But the problem is any form of enslavement, when there's not closure, there's not like real guidance out of that situation, what is mixed with other people, like the indigenous people that was in Liberia, you're going to have another form of power exchange. This is where the Civil War came from. Because the Americo-Liberians, when they came, they brought the political and the government mentality of the United States, you know, not necessarily the slavery, but that control and power and force to a land of people who are not really like them. You know, they spoke English. Liberia has indigenous people from different tribes. You know, there's over 20 some tribes. So you have language barrier, and you got, you know, people bring in the form of oppression that they have learned onto another. And now you have a power. The Miracle Liberians took over. They created a governmental structure. It's a good and bad thing. They prevented the indigenous Liberians from holding political power. So you know how that can be when that happens. That creates a war because you're fighting for power and control. So the relationship is a very sensitive one. It's a good and bad. And it's been that way ever since.
So when you, I guess, might say, repatriated to the United States, what holds the Liberian community together here?
You know, we are very, very family oriented. I think the first group of Liberians, especially that came here during the Civil War time, was escaping not just hardship or Civil War. Like my father filed for political asylum. When the Taylor regime took over, the government, you know, the problem is they end up trying to get rid of the original governments, which include the employees and stuff. And it's not just a pink slip of you're fired. It has a lot to do with killing, because they don't want you to regain power or try to overthrow who is trying to overthrow. So my father, he was a very quiet man. He didn't like trouble. He don't like problems. You know, he worked as a border patrol officer and in the immigration, being accused of trying to overthrow the government or some form of that way. And he was actually put in jail and he was beaten. I remember vaguely as a young visiting him in prison, and then after that point didn't see him again. And my mom didn't even know where he was. She thought he had actually died during the war. And my mom ended up facing a lot of prosecution because of my dad's position for working in the government. So that was the base. Migrating to the U.S. was for freedom, you know. And when we came, I think all the parents would tell their kids, you're here to get a better education. You're here to, you know, after education, get a good job. You know, you're here to foster your future and then help your family back home. So a lot of the parents that came in the 90s, they worked. You know, it was trying to locate lost relatives, children and parents and grandparents and so forth, and work to sustain the family in America and to help the family back home. And the children were here to learn. Education was strictly enforced. And when you find out that, oh, there's a family that's moving in, because, you know, Liberia is a small country, so it's a small village in a sense where everybody knows everybody a lot, you know, so my parents, you know, they learn of families or friends that they knew that was coming, and they encouraged them to move to Minnesota so we can be close. You want to be close to your community because your community understands you. They can mourn with you with things and support you in some way, make you feel at home, you know. So they stayed close. In the 90s, there was a lot of gatherings with families together, friends, you know, distant relatives, to keep cultural alive and to just be connected to each other. You know, it's like you to hold on and show some emotional support and it help also locate other families, because a lot of people will say, yeah, I saw, you know, your daughter, your son, your aunt, your uncle, your brother, you know, because people to escape the war went in different places, someone to Ivory Coast, someone to Ghana, someone to Nigeria. You know, they were all over trying to escape the war.
So really, you were refugees?
No, because the refugees originally, they come from actual refugee camps. That's the definition of a refugee. I think we found that out when Katrina happened and George Bush called the American residents in Katrina refugees. It was very upsetting, you know, because the definition of a refugee is not that. You know, you actually come from a refugee camp that was established for the purpose of wars that is happening in your country, and you're getting relief in a different country and so forth. So I was not part of the refugee camp. I know some people who was on the refugee camp. I have family who was on the refugee camp before they came, but me and my two other sisters, we were not on the refugee camp. My mother was an amazing mother and an amazing person. She actually had an orphanage back home before the war. She went through school and became a nurse midwife, and she was very engaged in social services, and she was the one who was able to file for us to bring us here.
It's Crown Up Boy, yeah.
After I pray, you came my way. So now they break like your face, I wanna see. I just wanna be loving you. Like how I wanna be. I will ride for you like Gange. Now I want you, you're not Bamble. I love you, Dr. Tate. Oh, got me singing like morning, oh, morning, babe. When you smile, the whole world freeze. Oh, da, da, da. When you pose, no need to say cheese. Oh, nah, nah. Your beauty, that newsletter, and carry the cheese. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. No competition, you take it with ease. Puta, puta, you know, but puta on my heart, too. For nobody, whoever your spot, oh. Morning, oh. Morning, baby. Morning, oh. Morning, baby. Morning, oh. Morning, baby.
my one, I won't pour you in glass. Fly set, man, I'll touch you when you pass. You find like a man and call a dad. You too metro, you not like fries. You my era, the new thing. Go for big party in the daily, oh. Me, I like good thing. Me, I like good thing. Let people don't want you, oh. Morning, oh, morning, baby. I just wanna say, morning, oh, morning, baby. Got a song for you, yeah, yeah. Morning, oh, morning, baby. Morning, oh, morning, baby. I'm in love with you. Hold on, King Java, see you, papi, oh yeah. See, I see.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. We just heard from Love Tima, a Liberian immigrant who told her story of how she came to America and, of course, how Liberia got started as a country. But it's time to continue the story of Buxton you heard about last week, and we have Rochelle Chase, who will tell her story of coming to Iowa and discovering Buxton. Hello, Rochelle.
Hello, Susan. Thanks for having me here.
Well, I'm so glad you could be here. So, how did you happen to discover Buxton? You're not from Iowa.
I'm not from Iowa. And for those who, you know, I'm sure most people know, but those people who don't, Buxton was a coal mining town that was established in 1900 by the Consolidation Coal Company, which was owned by the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. And it is pretty well known for being a very different coal mining town, both the town itself, but it's most renowned for the people. The fact that 40 to 55% of the population was African American for most of its existence, and that it was a thriving community. Blacks were treated equal. There was pretty much overall not much segregation. People did live like in Swede Town separate, but that was kind of by choice. It wasn't forced at all, but they were leaders in the community. African Americans were doctors, lawyers, dentists, pharmacists, justices of the peace, etc. So I, as you mentioned, did not live in Iowa. I was writing romance, and my romance writing instructor, who became a friend over the years, she lived here in Ottumwa. And she said, you know, next time you visit, we have to take you to what's left of this amazing town. And so she and her husband took me to Buxton, what's left. And we walked through the cornfields to get there. And I just couldn't believe that such a town existed here in Iowa. And as I would visit her, I would just keep going to the State Historical Society, and I would research and research. I would listen to these interviews that were done of the former residents that lived there. And the more I uncovered, the more amazed I was, and the more, you know, I couldn't believe this existed. So I had no idea what I was going to do with this research, because I was, again, writing romance. And then in 2014, I thought, well, you know what? I've done all this research. I don't know if I want to continue writing romance. I'm going to move to Iowa, and I want to go ahead and write a book on it. So Lost Buxton was then born, and that came out in 2017. And then Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa came out in 2019.
I've done quite a bit of research also on Buxton because of radio programs. There were some questions that I kept asking, and nobody seemed to really know the answers. And of course, the main one is who had the idea to create this kind of town. It was unique, but how did it happen? And I did find it had to do with Ben Buxton, but who he was and why he might have done this and what happened to him, I knew nothing about it. And then, of course, your book came and it answered all those questions. And a lot of individual, you have, but now, why don't you describe the difference between Lost Buxton and Creating the Black Utopia?
Lost Buxton is a pictorial history of Buxton. So I managed to find, I almost didn't think it was going to happen because I didn't know if I'd have enough images. It was hard to find them. The State Historical Society had a lot of images. And then I happened upon private collectors that had been collecting postcards, namely John Jacobs, who is a historian in Oskaloosa. He had, I want to say 50 or more postcards of Buxton and newspaper articles and such. So the point is, it became mainly pictures with, I put captions that were quotes from different people that live there, newspaper articles, et cetera, underneath the photos, because in a lot of those photos, you may not know who the people are. So I thought, well, you know, let's put quotes under there that kind of tell a story of what this picture represents. So as I was doing that, I realized, oh my gosh, but this just kind of, you know, whet my appetite for this story. And I was reading Dorothy Schweder's work and David Gradwall's work, and I was looking at, you know, the details around this. I wanted to know some of the more of the start to finish story, more of the Dorothy Schweder had mentioned welfare capitalism, but it was like a one liner in there. And I wanted to research and find out more about this. So the point I'm making is I just wanted to do more. And so I'd started researching some of the stuff in when I did Lost Buxton. I couldn't use it in that book. So I thought, okay, there's material here for another book. So that's when I did additional research and wrote Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa.
Well, that's a great story. And that answers a question that I already had, because I had I knew Dorothy and David pretty well. And we'd even talked about going down and doing a field trip to the Buxton site. And I noticed that on your website, now, this is a show where we keep talking about websites and Facebook pages, but on your website, what is your website again?
Well, I have a few. I have RochelleChase.com, which is more of me and, you know, some of the background and some of the other articles and such that are about Buxton and as it relates to things I've done. Then there's LostBuxton.com, which is the site that I sporadically, I need to do more, but as I come up with new things to write about, I put that information on lostbuxton.com. And so what you might be referring to, there was a gentleman there that had, you know, himself gone to the site and also had used my book and David Gradwell's books and others and had tried to kind of figure out where different things were located. So I do have that on the site. And again, I have some, you know, people I discovered, like there was a woman author, Margaret Coleman. I have a little bit on Hattie Hutchinson, which was the first African-American woman to get a degree in a pharmacy degree. She lived in Buxton. Buxton had a pharmacy with her husband. And then there's just some other ones there. So I just try again when I have time to write something and put them on that site.
Yeah, well, what impressed me was the little tour. Someone had done a virtual tour. So you see somebody motioning you down a path in Buxton.
Yeah.
So you can actually see what it looks like right now.
Yeah. Well, if you liked that, you'll like, I am launching a nonprofit, unitingthroughhistory.org, that's launching today. And one of the projects I'm working on with them is partnering with the University of Northern Iowa on a Main Street 360 project, which will allow for this digital experience or this 3D experience using old photographs of walking through Buxton and kind of seeing what that looked like. So that's a project that we will be, you know, raising funds for and working on, you know, to create that unique experience of Buxton.
We are launching the second annual Hip History Contest, which actually just started this week. And the entry form will be up on Friday. And what it is it's a contest for middle school and high school students where they're able to bring the history of Buxton alive through the arts and compete for a scholarship. The first prize is $2,000, then there's a second prize of $500, and a third prize of $250. And new this year, we also offer the winner's school will get a matching prize. So that's pretty exciting as well. And students can enter whatever they want to do in terms of, you know, I use the arts loosely, whatever they want. Last year, we had some really creative entries. We had a student create a song and sing it and play a guitar. We had one of our winners did a painting, a time-lapse painting of an interracial couple. We had mini documentaries and puppet shows and just a variety. Even one young man did a vintage television set with flying pigs. So it really was a lot of creativity. And we're really hoping to see more of that this year. We had about 60 students enter about 40 entries last year. So we really want to see more of that.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the schools?
The schools, it's been great. We had one of the teachers had mentioned that she had never seen her students so interested in going to the library and researching. Our first place middle school winners, it was a group project, and they created a little skit on Buxton, somebody comparing and contrasting, you know, what miners were making and what life was like in different places. And they really treated it as like a mini project management kind of thing, where one student was responsible for like the green screen, another one was responsible for the script. They got together on Snapchat and did, you know, their communications, and they spent time at the library. So we just really have gotten really good feedback from both the students and the teachers.
That's wonderful, especially in a time like this, when teachers and books and and certainly Black history is under attack.
Yeah. And, you know, we had wondered about that this year, if that was going to have an impact on people wanting teachers, you know, embracing this contest, because that is Uniting Through History's mission to increase pride and acceptance of the fact that Black history is American history. And of course, with Buxton, the African-American contributions and experience is a key component of the story. So far though, that has not been the case. I haven't even barely started promoting it. And I have teachers that have contacted me wanting more information, saying that they want their classes to participate. So it's really great that this banning is not going to hopefully diminish participation in our contest. Well, and I forgot to mention where people could go. I always forget that. They can go to unitingthroughhistory.org to get more information on the contest. Just look at the menu and click on the Hip History Contest, and the details are there.
That sounds really exciting. And you're launching this on the website with the application form this Friday?
Yes, the actual contest rules are there. The judges that will be participating are there. I forgot to mention that in addition to the cash prizes, well, they're not going to be cash prizes. They will actually be a scholarship as a requirement. Students or their parents will have to open a College Savings Iowa 529 plan, which takes literally about 5 minutes to open. And then we will deposit the money in there, because we really want it to go towards college or career or, you know, school materials, that sort of thing. So yes, the contest details are up on the website right now, and the actual entry form will be up on Friday.
Would you give that website one more time?
Yes, the details for the Hip History Contest are at unitingthroughhistory.org, and just click the Hip History Contest link under projects, and it'll give you all the information there.
Well, thank you so much, Rochelle.
All right. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
students to find out, besides books, are there some displays around Iowa?
Yes, there are various places people can go to learn, to actually learn more and see more about Buxton. There's the actual site itself, which there's not much left there, but what is left is maintained by the Monroe County Historical Society in Albia. So if you check in with them, you can visit the site. They also have a small exhibit there about Buxton. The Nelson Pioneer Farm in Oskaloosa has a Buxton house there that they have put period pieces of furniture inside. It's not actual furniture from Buxton, but it gives you an idea of what the houses were like there. And they have other buildings that were from that time period as well that weren't from Buxton. There's the African American Museum in Cedar Rapids that has a small Buxton display, and I believe they have a few artifacts from Buxton. And then there's the State Historical Society of Iowa that has some photos, old photos of Buxton, and they have the actual audio interviews that Dorothy Schweder had done with former residents of Buxton that she used, you know, in her book.
Well, there's a lot there for students to do their displays or their entries. I would think that it's a very inspiring beginning for a lot of students. Find out what research is like, find out how their history might tie into this.
Oh, and I meant to mention also at the site, the Buxton site, there's also the restored cemetery there that lists the various people that were buried in the cemetery. So that's also another place people can visit.
You know, since so many people are now finding out genealogy, it might be fun to find, even if you just had the names, to find, yeah. Oh, maybe that's my great-grandparents.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's what made me think of it when you said, kid, you know, young people might be able to research their own family. So that made me think of the cemetery.
Thank you.
And all right. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Susan Franzen. Today's guests were Diane Burt, Maria Hakimi, Love Tima, and Rachel Chase. KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. Live streaming of our broadcasts can be found online at khoifm.org. At noon today, you can hear Capital Week, our weekly conversation between Laura Bellin of Bleeding Heartland and Dennis Hart of KHOI. This week, the second half of Capital Week is the press conference called by the Iowa Interfaith Alliance, Confronting Extremism and Hate Speech. You can listen to today's Local Talk and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. If you want to become a member, you can go to our website, khoifm.org, and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.